So today we are embarking on chapter 28. This is actually the last book, the last chapter of the first book of the Life Divine. It means since we started in, when was it, December 2007, I think, we've covered, or we are covering, now this first book of the Life Divine. It's maybe worthwhile, before we look at this last chapter, to have a look at the contents page and just have a look at this journey that we've taken. I don't know how it is in your book, but in my book, the title of book one is not given on the contents page. The title of book one is Omnipresent Reality and the Universe. So we found that there's this first chapter, which is a wonderful introductory chapter, which sets out Sri Aurobindo's basic position. If I have to choose one sentence from this chapter, I would say, evolution is a word which merely states the phenomenon without explaining it. And there seems to be no reason why life should evolve out of material elements, or mind out of living form, unless we accept the Vedantic solution that life is already involved in matter and mind in life, because in essence matter is a form of veiled life, life a form of veiled consciousness. But the title of the chapter is The Human Aspiration, and Sri Aurobindo is speaking there about the persistence of this sense that all human beings have somewhere within them, and which reasserts itself again and again and again, that there must be something better than this life that we have. There's this human aspiration for what we might label God, light, freedom, immortality. These are among the labels that human beings have put on their aspiration. And he tells us that this aspiration is the sign that coded into us is a possibility of realizing those things that we are aspiring for. We couldn't aspire for them unless that possibility were somewhere meant, someday, somehow meant to be achieved. So Sri Aurobindo's question is, can this be achieved here on earth in the material universe? He says it can, that this is the achievement that is meant. He says there are two major denials to this. The first denial he deals with is the materialist denial, which says all this aspiration is moonshine, and here we are in the world of matter, and that's all there is. But Sri Aurobindo doesn't entirely dismiss the materialist position. He says that it has been of great value in the evolution of consciousness and continues perhaps to be. On the other hand, he says there's the much more dangerous refusal of the ascetic, the spiritual urge, which makes us feel that what we're aiming for, that wonderful state that we're aspiring for, can't possibly be achieved here on earth, and has drawn away so many souls into other realms. They've achieved great spiritual achievements, but they have left the earth very much as it was. But he says we should never underestimate what the sacrifice of all those great souls has brought to our human consciousness and to our human evolution. So then, in four following chapters, reality, omnipresent, the destiny of the individual, man in the universe, and the ego and the dualities, Sri Aurobindo looks at various different aspects, very, very illumining chapters with a kind of general application. And he summarizes these chapters in the last paragraph of chapter 7. We could just have a look at that paragraph. These are the conclusions. This chapter gives the conclusions that Sri Aurobindo has led us through his luminous reasoning in the course of the preceding chapters. He takes them point by point. We have then the manifestation of the divine conscious being in the totality of physical nature as the foundation of human existence in the material universe. This is what he really means by the omnipresent reality, that the highest reality that we can conceive of is actually in everything, everywhere. It is the foundation of our human existence in the material universe. We have the emergence of that conscious being in an involved and inevitably evolving life, mind, and supermind as the condition of our activities. The gradual emergence of this involved conscious being. This is the condition of all our movements. It is this evolution which has enabled man to appear in matter. And it is this evolution which will enable him progressively to manifest God in the body, the universal incarnation. So according to Sri Aurobindo, the evolutionary process is not finished and will not be finished until the full supreme reality to which we give the name Satchidananda will be entirely expressed in the material universe, in the universal incarnation. In egoistic formation, our individual, limited individual formation, we have the intermediate and decisive factor which allows the one to emerge as the conscious many out of that indeterminate totality, general, obscure, and formless, which we call the subconscient, Hridaya Samudra. the ocean heart in things of the Rig Veda. Sri Aurobindo gives great importance to the formation of the conscious individual in humanity. He says it is the decisive factor which allows the Supreme One, the One Omnipresent Reality, to emerge out, to evolve out of this indeterminate soup of subconscious nature. The One emerges as the conscious many. He's not fully conscious in us, but we begin to be conscious. We become conscious individuals, and this is a very important stage in the whole process. But this egoistic consciousness, this limited individuality that we have, which subjects us to, because we are limited, it subjects us to death, desire, and incapacity. It subjects us also to the dualities. We have the dualities of life and death, joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain, truth and error, good and evil, as the first formations of egoistic consciousness. The natural and inevitable outcome of its attempt to realize unity in an artificial construction of itself, exclusive of the total truth, good, life, and delight of being in the universe. As long as we are limited consciousnesses, we are subject to the dualities. So we have the dissolution of this egoistic construction. It has been necessary, but at a certain stage it has to be dissolved. It is the means of that supreme fulfillment to which egoistic life is only a prelude, even as animal life was only a prelude to the human. We have the realization of the all in the individual by the transformation of the limited ego into a conscious center of the divine unity and freedom, as the term at which the fulfillment arrives. This is what our yoga aims at: the realization of the all in the individual by the transformation of the limited ego that we are now, the limited individual formation that we are now, into a conscious individual center of the divine unity and freedom. That's the term to which the fulfillment arrives. And as a result, we have the outflowing of the infinite and absolute existence, truth, good, and delight of being on the many in the world, as the divine result towards which the cycles of our evolution move. This is the supreme birth which maternal nature holds in herself. Of this she strives to be delivered. All that we experience are as if the birth pangs of this great fulfillment. So here in this one paragraph, we have in a way a summary of the whole theme of the book. It's worth concentrating on going into more detail on our own. Then Sri Aurobindo has a chapter about methodology. What methods are we going to accept in our investigation? The methods of Vedantic knowledge. This is a very, very interesting chapter from the point of view of psychology. How is it possible for we who are limited by our physical senses to assure ourselves or to be able in any way to test or verify truths which are necessarily supraphysical? How can this be done? Sri Aurobindo tells us that we have within us a faculty, a sense of ourself. At present, that's limited to our egoistic consciousness. But if we can undertake the effort, which yoga gives the methods for, of expanding our sense of self, we can develop first the faculty of intuition and finally come to knowledge by identity. Knowing things the way that we know things within ourselves. We know when we are hungry, we know when we are angry, we know when we are in love. In the same way, if we can expand our sense of self, we can test the truths, or we can test the statements, the formulations, the communications that have come to us by those who have done that and who have experienced things in a wider and higher way. Then in the remaining chapters, almost up to the end of the book, up to chapter 25, so starting with chapter 9 and up to 25, Sri Aurobindo leads us through a consideration of all the principles and levels of consciousness, starting with the pure existent. And then he goes on to that other aspect of the pure existent, its consciousness and its power. And the third aspect is the aspect of delight. And there under delight of existence, he deals with the problem that we experience about that. If we are told that omnipresent reality is pure delight of existence, we immediately say, how come there can be so much pain in the world? So he deals with this in two chapters, the problem and the solution. But then, if we admit that the highest formulation we can give for this omnipresent reality can be expressed in the Indian term Sat-Chit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, which contains within it force and will and delight. How does that pure Sat-Chit-Ananda manifest itself as all this world, which seems to be the very contradiction of pure existence, consciousness, and bliss? How does it happen? So he leads us through the downward steps, the downward process. In the chapter, The Divine Maya, he introduces us to his own term, the term of supermind, and he links that to what in the Veda is called truth consciousness, which has two aspects, truth seeing and truth hearing. It's the way that the rishis have expressed it. He explains to us that unless there is some such truth consciousness, creative truth consciousness, there seems to be no way that Satchidananda could become all this. He discusses also the meaning of the word Maya. Maya in later times has been taken to mean illusion, but he explains to us that it's in fact a faculty of self-limitation, willed self-limitation. So this divine Maya he equates with supermind, and he examines the functions and faculties and possibilities of supermind in the following three chapters. And in chapter 17, the divine soul, he examines what an individualized being who lives in this supermind consciousness, how would that being experience a manifestation of the many? Very differently from the way in which we experience it, because it would be conscious always of its origin, of its connection with the One, that it is an individualized expression of certain potentiality of the One. It would recognize that the One is present in all the other individualities, that they are equally expressions of the original divine in some individualization of itself, some willed self-limitation. And it would experience the One, the oneness in essence and in relation, as well as in its own individuality. And of course we have that wonderful aphorism of Sri Aurobindo, in which he expresses what an image, a poetic image for what this state would be. He said it would be as if there's a honeycomb in which every drop of honey not only experiences its own sweetness, but all the different sweetnesses of all the other drops, and the sweetness of the honey as a whole. And the one honeycomb would experience the separate delight of each of the drops and of itself encompassing them all. He puts it much better than I do. I should have brought the text with me. So then, what is the relation between mind and supermind? He shows us that our mind, individualizing mind, is a derivation of that supermind, of that truth consciousness, which has come about by a willed acceptance of forgetfulness of the origin, the acceptance to enter into the state of avidya, of ignorance, to cut itself off from the awareness of the origin. Life, then, is the expression as conscious force of that consciousness, that existence of mind. And in life, with expressing itself as all these limited forms and individualities, we come across the problem of death, desire, and incapacity. So Sri Aurobindo deals with these problems in the next two chapters, the problem of life and the double soul in man. He explains that we have within us the original projection the real idea each of us is carrying within us, some essential truth which we've come here to manifest. But this is expressed on the surface in our life self by a kind of desire self, which is jostling and shoving with all the other desire selves to get the most it can out of this limited existence it's experiencing itself in at the moment. He says, if we can step back, if we can begin to live within, if we can come in touch, he says, if not with the Lord himself, at least with his radiant penumbra within us, then we can begin to live a completely different kind of life. The method he gives is to go deeper into ourselves, not to live on the surface. To spend at least some time finding deeper and deeper levels of ourselves, concentrating deeper inside. And then he turns to matter. He says, all this, what I've already said, it is known, it is understood in the spiritual tradition of India. But it seems that everybody has decided it's impossible to combine these realizations with a life in, or it's impossible to express these realizations fully in the material life. And why would that be? So what is matter? Matter, he says, expresses to the ultimate this principle of separation, of division. It's at the absolute other end of the scale from the oneness of the One. The One has decided to subdivide himself right down to the subatomic particle and coming back up in the process of evolution. It's not by a real oneness, it's by some kind of aggregation of parts which have independent existence in themselves. The knot of matter. Here we are living, beginning to live a mental life. We have the life, life has been on earth for I forget how many billion years. But the life and the consciousness here is subject to the domination of matter. It's been chosen like this. So it's in a way, if we want to solve this problem of a divine life on earth, is that possible? It has to be solved in matter. And in the next chapter, the ascending series of substance, he examines, are there any grounds for thinking that it would be possible in matter to live any different kind of life than the one we experience? And he explains to us that matter is not the only kind of substance that there is, that each of these levels or planes of being that he's described, they exist, and they on those planes there's a corresponding kind of substance, and there's a corresponding beings who have forms in those substances. And even we within ourselves, we have, since our earth is made of an involution of all these planes, we contain all these possibilities within ourselves. We don't only have this external, most gross physical body that we know. We have also something a bit subtler, our energy body, our prana body. And beyond that, there's a mental body. And beyond that, there's something that is called in Sanskrit an ideal body. And beyond that is even a body of bliss, the body that is native to our divine soul, to our divine individuality. So if we can live in consciousness in those other bodies, it's possible, it's conceivable that we can impose the laws of our subtler bodies on this material, physical, and get it to change its way of behaving. I think the paragraph where he describes this is a very interesting one if we're thinking in terms of physical transformation. How could that come about? It's not just by some magic. No? First, we have to really identify ourselves with other levels of consciousness. And Sri Aurobindo, not here, but elsewhere, has said that really this problem can only be solved by re-entering into the truth consciousness, the supermind, and imposing its law on the physical. And of course, that's what he was doing himself. This was the work that the mother undertook, and this was the principle that they wanted to bring into active, into activity here in our earth. And we believe that they've done that, and that this is now working itself out, that the nature of matter will change because of that. Then Sri Aurobindo summarizes all this in the sevenfold cord of being. He shows that there's a kind of correspondence between sat and matter, between chit and mind, between ananda and our soul, and between supermind and mind. The correspondence between chit shakti is with life, mind and supermind. So now he's going to tie up all the loose threads in this 28th chapter. It's very nice to have a look at the paper we've been given. Sri Aurobindo begins each of the chapters of the Life Divine with some small quotations from the Veda, from the Upanishads. And one of his disciples, Madhav Pandit, has very nicely explained to us what some of these quotations imply and mean. So this little paper can become like a kind of memory of what was in the chapter. But these we take home and read by ourselves. We don't read them together now. Chapter 28. Supermind, mind, and the overmind Maya. There is a permanent, a truth, hidden by a truth where the sun unyokes his horses. The 10 hundreds of his rays came together. That one, I saw the most glorious of the forms of the God. Rig Veda. The face of truth is hidden by a golden lid. That remove, O fostering sun, for the law of the truth, for sight. O sun, O soul seer, marshal thy rays, gather them together. Let me see of thee thy happiest form of all. That conscious being everywhere, he am I. Ishopanishad. The truth, the right, the vast. Atharva Veda. It became both truth and falsehood. It became the truth, even all this that is. Taittiriya Upanishad. So the first one is from the Rig Veda. There is a permanent, a truth, and that truth is hidden by another truth. Where the sun unyokes his horses, he lets them free. The horses are the powers. So, but if the 10 hundreds of all the horses, all the different rays come together, that then we see that one. And then you can say, I saw the most glorious of the forms of the gods, the supreme form. So the Ishopanishad puts it in another way. It's the same idea, and a wonderful invocation. The face of truth is hidden by a golden lid. That golden lid is the truth where the sun unyokes his horses. Sri Aurobindo calls it the overmind. So we pray to the fostering sun, Pushan, to remove that golden lid. Let us see things as they really are. No? And then he prays to Pushan, to the other names of the gods, to gather all your rays together. Let me see of thee thy happiest form of all. And when we see that, then we realize that we ourselves, we are that conscious being everywhere. When we listen to the mantra, it is saying much the same thing. No, it says, we meditate on the supreme form of the sun, no, that will illumine us with the truth. So we want to go beyond all the other forms, go to the supreme form, open ourselves to that light, then we will be able to see things as they really are. Then the truth, the right, the vast. This was the Vedic formula for that highest aim that they were aiming at. And Sri Aurobindo says these are the three characteristics of the truth consciousness that he calls supermind. And that truth and right and vast, that supreme sun, has become both the truth and the falsehood. It's become this world of reality that we know, our reality. And he says, even this world that seems to us illusory, not as it should be, in a way, that is the truth, became the truth, even all this that is. This expresses his idea of the omnipresent reality of the supreme truth. One point remains to be cleared, which we have till now left in obscurity. The process of the lapse into the ignorance. For we have seen that nothing in the original nature of mind, life, or matter necessitates a fall from knowledge. It has been shown, indeed, that division of consciousness is the basis of the ignorance. a division of individual consciousness from the cosmic and the transcendent, of which yet it is an intimate part, in essence inseparable. A division of mind from the supramental truth of which it should be a subordinate action. Of life from the original force of which it is one energism, of matter from the original existence of which it is one form of substance. But it has still to be made clear how this division came about in the indivisible. By what peculiar self-diminishing or self-effacing action of consciousness force in the being. For since all is a movement of that force, only by some such action obscuring its own plenary light and power can there have arisen the dynamic and effective phenomenon of the ignorance. But this problem can be left over to be treated in a more close examination of the dual phenomenon of knowledge-ignorance, which makes our consciousness a blend of light and darkness, a half-light between the full day of the supramental truth and the night of the material inconscience. All that is necessary to note at present is that it must be in its essential character an exclusive concentration on one movement and status of conscious being, which puts all the rest of consciousness and being behind and veils it from that one movement's now partial knowledge. 1 point remains to be cleared, which we have till now left in obscurity. The process of the lapse into the ignorance. For we've seen that nothing in the original nature of mind, life, or matter necessitates a fall from the knowledge. There's nothing essentially undivine in either matter or life or mind. So how has this lapse, this fall into the ignorance, come about? So he says, indeed, we have seen that division of consciousness is the basis of the ignorance. The limitation of standpoints to individual, small, limited individual standpoints, and a division from the one origin. So a division of individual consciousness from the cosmic, from the rest of the universe, and from the transcendent, even though the individual consciousness is an intimate part not only of the cosmos, but also of the transcendent. In essence, we are inseparable from that. And there's a division of these powers, of faculties. There's a division of mind from the supramental truth consciousness, of which it should be just a subordinate action, this individualizing action, apprehending action. Sri Aurobindo calls it apprehending action. the division of life from that original conscious force of which it is only one energism. The conscious force can express itself in many other ways, but this life that we know is only one energism of that original force. And there's a division of matter from the original existence, of which it is just one form of substance. So we know that division is the principle that's brought all this about, but how could this division come about in the indivisible, in the indivisible one? By what peculiar self-diminishing or self-effacing action of conscious force into being? He says, since all is a movement of that conscious force of the one existence, it's only by some such action of obscuring its own full light and power that there can have arisen this dynamic and effective phenomenon of the ignorance. In one way, it's something illusory, but it has a reality. It's dynamic and it's effective. Then he says that he's going to leave this problem over to be treated in the examination, to the examination of the dual phenomenon of knowledge and ignorance. And that's actually the title of the second book of the Life Divine. That comes in the next book, the relationship of knowledge and ignorance, the being of knowledge and our life in the ignorance. So this dual phenomenon of knowledge-ignorance, which makes our consciousness a blend of light and darkness, a half-light, a twilight between the full day of the supramental truth consciousness and the night of the material inconscience, where there seems to be no consciousness at all, or consciousness has fallen asleep. So he says he's going to examine all this much more in detail, but now, he says, all that is necessary to note at present is that whatever has brought about this division, it must be in its essential character an exclusive concentration on one movement and status of conscious being, which puts all the rest of consciousness and being behind and veils it from that one movement's now partial knowledge. So elsewhere he's given the example of the creative writer, the poet or the dramatist, who when he's writing his drama or his novel, for example, concentrates on each of his characters exclusively when he's absorbed in writing that part. He puts all the rest of his own individual consciousness away. He sees everything only from the standpoint of that one character as long as he's creating him. No? So there's a kind of faculty in us of exclusive concentration by which we could, by an analogy, we can begin to understand perhaps what the Creator did in permanently concentrating some part of his or some aspect of his consciousness exclusively on each of these real ideas from which all the forms of the universe have emerged. Putting all the rest of consciousness and being behind veils it from that one movement's now partial knowledge. But now in this last chapter he wants to consider one aspect of this problem. Maybe I will just read this paragraph and then we'll look at it in more detail next time. Still, there is one aspect of this problem which must be immediately considered. It is the gulf created between mind as we know it and the supramental truth consciousness, of which we have found mind in its origin to be a subordinate process. There seems to be such a huge gap between what we know as mind and that truth consciousness. For this gulf is considerable. And if there are no gradations between the two levels of consciousness, a transition from one to the other, either in the descending involution of spirit into matter, or the corresponding evolution in matter of the concealed grades leading back to the spirit, seems in the highest degree improbable, if not impossible. How can it come about if there are no intermediary grades between mind and supermind? For mind as we know it is a power of the ignorance, seeking for truth, groping with difficulty to find it, reaching only mental constructions and representations of it in word and idea, in mind formations, sense formations, as if bright or shadowy photographs or films of a distant reality were all that it could achieve. Supermind, on the contrary, is in actual and natural possession of the truth, and its formations are forms of the reality, not constructions, representations, or indicative figures. No doubt, the evolving mind in us is hampered by its encasement in the obscurity of this life and body. And the original mind principle in the involutionary descent is a thing of greater power to which we have not fully reached, able to act with freedom in its own sphere or province, to build more revelatory constructions, more minutely inspired formations, more subtle and significant embodiments in which the light of truth is present and palpable. So this obscuring of mind which we experience because we are here in a universe that's dominated by the material principle doesn't apply to mind as such on its own plane. But still, that too is not likely to be essentially different in its characteristic action. For it too is a movement into the ignorance, not a still unseparated portion of the truth consciousness. We saw that that is what mind is. It's this divided consciousness which accepts the step into ignorance. There must be somewhere in the descending and ascending scale of being an intermediate power and plane of consciousness. Perhaps something more than that. Something with an original creative force through which the involutionary transition from mind in the knowledge to mind in the ignorance was effected, and through which again the evolutionary reverse transition becomes intelligible and possible. What is that linking principle? For in the evolution there are indeed radical transitions from indeterminate energy to organized matter. It's a leap, no? It's what they call a quantum leap from that primal energy soup after the Big Bang to what we know as organized atoms and molecules. No? This has taken billions of years to happen. But there's a transition there from indeterminate energy to organized matter. In the same way, there's a transition which the scientists still haven't been able to explain, from inanimate matter to life, to living matter. And then from a subconscious or submental to a perceptive and feeling and acting life. And then from primitive animal mentality to conceptive reasoning mind, observing and governing life, and observing itself also, able to act as an independent entity, and even to seek consciously for self-transcendence. So each of these stages is a kind of leap. But he says, these leaps, even when considerable, are to some extent prepared by slow gradations which make them conceivable and feasible. There can be no such immense hiatus as seems to exist between supramental truth consciousness and the mind in the ignorance. So in the rest of the chapter, he's going to speak to us about these gradations. What they would mean for us in our evolutionary upward effort. He's going to fill in the apparently immense hiatus. Yeah. I think we'll leave it there for today. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.